SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
A partner at McKinsey & Company.
I lead our culture and change work. I also lead our Change Leaders Forum, which is an executive capability program for how to drive change.
She has helped lead major transformations at companies across multiple geographies and sectors.
And companies that emphasized health as much as they did performance or culture were actually three times more likely to have higher total returns to shareholders.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Brooke Weddle. Now, here's your host, Howard Wolf.
Today, we're going to be talking about the COVID-19 pandemic again. We are not, however, going to be talking about the virus. Instead, we're going to talk about the impact the virus and the resulting pandemic have had on organizations and how they function, with a specific focus on the changing nature of work. We all know the story. In a matter of days, in March of 2019, millions of organizations around the world fundamentally changed the way in which they worked. Office-based workers were sent home to a new virtual world where Zoom became a verb and screens took over our worlds. And we operated this way for nearly a year and a half. As we start to see the light at the end of the tunnel, we hope more and more workers are being invited back to their offices to resume quote unquote normal operations. The reception to these invitations, however, has been less than positive. Many of us have ended up embracing the work from home phenomenon and are not at all excited about spending 5 days per week in the office again. Some of us want to stay entirely remote. Others want a hybrid structure where we work some days in the office and other days from home or elsewhere. And some want a combination of hybrid and remote. What no one wants, it would appear, is a return to the old days. And this reality has become a huge challenge to leaders of managed organizations. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders, Brooke Weddle, is helping leaders of organizations grapple with this challenge. Brooke is a partner at McKinsey & Company, the international management consulting powerhouse. She plays many roles at McKinsey, where she helps executives drive transformational change and boost organizational effectiveness. And as you might imagine, she is beyond busy these days. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard. Great to be here.
So I always like to start my shows with the exact same question, and that is your Stanford origin story.
My uncle did go to Stanford as an undergrad, so have a little bit of a family connection. It just sounded like an idyllic place to study. I know that sounds cliche. And when I first visited Stanford, I had actually never been to California before. Oh. So you can imagine, you know, driving up Palm Drive, the quad, I went running at the dish, right? All the bikes, the lifestyle. It was amazing. And in the end, I actually chose Stanford twice because I started off in a PhD program in Spanish literature and then switched to a PhD program in international comparative education. So I'm proud of the fact that I chose Stanford twice and have never looked back.
Okay, so hold on a second. Talk a little bit about that switch because that's not that ordinary. Tell me what happened there.
Well, I thought when I applied to Stanford originally, I was an undergrad at UVA and had done, I went and did a year as a Fulbright scholar. I thought I wanted to be a Spanish professor, a professor of Spanish literature. And so I enrolled in the PhD program at Stanford. It has an amazing program in Spanish literature. And continued to love it, right? Garcia Marquez, right? I did kind of the whole Garcia Lorca Spanish, right? Studied all of the Argentinian and other Latin American authors, and eventually decided I still loved Spanish literature. But I started hanging out in Cubberly, mostly because Guadalupe Valdez was a professor over there. And so I would visit her and do office hours. And she told me that I should go see someone named Martin Carnoy, who was a professor in the Ed School and actually, you know, had trained as a labor economist. So I not only went and saw Martin, but I started taking his class. And I decided that really I wanted to go back to economics and study economics at the intersection of human capital theory. And so ultimately, I reapplied to Stanford as a PhD candidate in education. And that's when I started that PhD program, which ultimately was how I finished my career at Stanford.
So you had an academic affair with another department.
Yeah, I did. Sounds far more scandalous than it actually was. It was fabulous. I mean, what kind of a place, you know, kind of allows you to explore such connections and helps you be successful in that? It's absolutely fantastic.
So when you get the PhD in international comparative education,
yeah,
you still thought you wanted to be a faculty member?
No. So at that point, you know, kind of year 4 or 5, I started thinking, gosh, you know, I was doing all this field work in Peru. I studied small business owners who were receiving microcredit, and I studied how their education level impacted how well they did with that microcredit in terms of realizing returns. And I just loved being at the center of the action, right? And working with these entrepreneurs and kind of figuring out ways to make life better for them, right? And improve these economies. And so one day I was walking home from class at Stanford, and there was this McKinsey presentation happening. And I could see inside because the room was all glass. And they were doing like some video, right? And so I said, okay, they probably had free food too. So I said, okay, I'll go in and check this out. And McKinsey's motto then and now is, you know, it's all about impact. And so I went in and I just fell in love, right? With what McKinsey was saying and the opportunities to travel, work on big, hairy, challenging questions. I applied. I'd never heard of a case study, and for whatever reason, they accepted me, and here I am.
So this is absolute and total serendipity. That's how you found McKinsey & Company.
Yeah.
Had you ever heard of McKinsey & Company?
I knew that Chelsea Clinton had worked there, but that was about it. I mean, this makes me sound kind of like I was living under a rock, but as a PhD student, you kind of do live under a rock. So yeah, that was really it. And like had a great experience interviewing. And I ultimately interviewed at Google and McKinsey, but everyone at Google that I met, the people that I liked the most, were actually former McKinsey. So I said, oh, well, I'll go to McKinsey for a few years and then I'll go to Google while I'm still at McKinsey. So clearly that didn't work out, but that's how it all played out.
All right, so McKinsey is this international management consulting powerhouse. And, you know, phenomenally well-regarded internationally. What is your role at that firm?
I'm a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of McKinsey. And I lead our culture and change work. I also lead our Change Leaders Forum, which is a executive capability program for how to drive change as a leader in your organization. And then I'm also a leader in our aerospace and defense practice. And do a lot of work in other industries as well, particularly in healthcare and in banking.
What is corporate culture and why is corporate culture so important? Because this is a big area of focus for you.
Yes, it is. I'm very passionate about it. So corporate culture, I would describe as a set of management practices that an organization decides to prioritize and emphasize. And those management practices translate into behaviors, how you and I act, right, on a day-to-day basis in the organization. And that's what you can see. What you can't see about corporate culture are the mindsets that inform those behaviors. So what do I believe that drives the way I behave? And that is even deeper seated in one's values, right? And organizations typically have a set of values that help to shape those mindsets, that help to shape those behaviors. So that's how we think about it. And when you look at the statistics on corporate culture, it's actually really hard to ignore the importance of it, I would argue. First of all, we have seen data that shows that culture drives performance. So McKinsey did some research. We call culture organizational health. That's how we refer to it. And we did research back in the early 2000s about what separated companies that perform for long periods of time from those that were a blip on the radar. And companies that emphasized health as much as they did performance or culture were actually three times more likely to have higher total returns to shareholders. They had higher productivity rates. They had, even when you look inside like a hospital, they have fewer patient error rates. I mean, the relationship between performance and culture is extremely strong. We also know it's a critical factor in driving the success of transformations. And the really interesting thing about corporate culture is it's really hard to replicate. If you think about Google, Amazon, right? Bridgeport, right, is another example. Those are cultures that even if you decided that you wanted to be like them, it'd be really hard to replicate that, right? And so it can be a source of competitive advantage for companies as they think about, you know, attracting employees and really staking out different ground vis-a-vis customers and other kind of organizations.
The point in time where I realized how important culture was when I heard the quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yes.
I don't know if that was Peter Drucker. No one knows exactly who said it. Maybe it was Peter Drucker, but that to me just encapsulated it, because if you don't have your culture right, you can try every strategy you want, but it's not going to work. You've got to get your culture right. How has the pandemic shaped and impacted culture in the organizations that you work with?
Well, so I think we got a long ways to go, by the way. I think this is going to be dynamic for a while. I think first and foremost, the pandemic has impacted culture because it's cast a spotlight on it. I have never had so many clients asking about how do I create culture in this environment, or how do I maintain culture, or how do I reinvent culture? These are some of the questions that I would say the lion's share of companies are asking these days. The other way that the pandemic has impacted culture is by it's changed the way in which companies can be healthy or have healthy cultures. So we did some research that showed that the healthiest companies, so the companies with the strongest performing cultures in the pandemic, emphasized three things. One, they were emphasizing bottom-up innovation, getting lots of ideas, right? And sharing knowledge across the enterprise. Two, they were actually building that in to their ongoing management practices by emphasizing things like process-based capabilities, so codifying new things that they were learning along the ways, updating roles and responsibilities. And then the last thing, and there's been, you know, quite a bit written about this, they were leading by being inspiring, by appealing to meaning, even love. We've heard that, right? And that's really different in terms of what people and organizations had previously emphasized when they talked about corporate culture.
And different cultures, I would imagine, embrace different forms of work. And that is a great segue for the next part of our conversation. So there's tremendous discussion and talk these days about hybrid work.
Yeah.
So this is something you've focused on. What is hybrid work and why is it so popular today as we come out of the pandemic?
Yeah, well, so the simplest definition of hybrid work is some combination of working in office and out of the office.
Okay.
And I say that intentionally because it's not necessarily work from home. There are a lot of people who are actually not working from home even when they are not in the office. There's all sorts of things happening, but in the simplest way, hybrid means having some combination of in-office and out-of-office work for employees. And, you know, why is it popular today? Well, so the research would say that there are several benefits. There's less wasted time. You know, all of the commutes, all of the times that, you know, I personally got on airplanes for, you know, a two-hour meeting, you could argue that that was had some wasted time built in. certainly greater flexibility with respect to where you can work and how you do work, right? Potential for greater inclusion. Now there's a flip side to that, which would say that actually as we think about hybrid models, the folks that are best able to come back are those that are more senior or have the kinds of jobs that position them well for that. And those jobs aren't distributed equally among men or women or other kinds of demographic categories. A couple of other benefits would be the level playing field between headquarters and other kind of regional sites, right? If everyone is kind of doing the hybrid thing, then it, there's less of an emphasis on being seen at headquarters. And then I would say another one is the site agnostic talent. So we've seen a lot of innovation and a lot of open-mindedness about recruiting in a much more open way. So I, if I'm just looking for the best person, I don't need to just look, you know, I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. right now. In Washington, D.C., I can really cast a much broader net in terms of finding the best talent if we're going to be working in a hybrid way anyways.
So in much of life, there are winners and losers. So who are the winners and who are the losers in the hybrid world? Because I work here at Stanford, as you know, of course, and we're moving towards a hybrid world where we would work part of the time in the office on campus, part of the time elsewhere, whether it's at home or elsewhere. And there are certain people who love this idea. There's certain people who hate this idea. There's certain people for whom this will work well, others it won't. Give us a sense for what you're experiencing, what you're seeing in the workplace.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that maybe this is stating the obvious, but needs and experiences really vary. A lot of people doing research in this space have pointed to the mass personalization of change component of the pandemic. And there's this one CHRO interview that McKinsey did, and the CHRO of Unilever said—
That's the chief human resource officer.
Chief human resource officer at Unilever, Unilever said, we are in the same storm, but we are in different boats, right? And I actually thought that was kind of a nice way of putting it. We have data that show that, so this is with respect to positive work experiences, 39% of offsite, so remote workers versus 21% onsite workers are having a positive work experience. So that's quite a disparity. Then you look at data that show people with dependents versus people without dependents, lots of differences. In fact, people with dependents actually report more positive work experiences. But guess what? Those numbers accrue completely differently to men and women. So men are the ones driving the positive work experience versus women who, you know, speaking of, I would say those that are not necessarily benefiting, women have been reporting much higher kind of after work burden as a result of hybrid work and the pandemic. A couple of other segments, Black women, 52% of them report being the only one of their gender or race in the room still, and they are 2.5 times more likely to report the death of a loved one being a big challenge. And then the other category I'd point to is senior level women who are reporting much higher levels of exhaustion and burnt out and feeling more pressure when compared to men to feel like they are always on. So those are the ones that I would say, you know, we've got to really focus on and understand how we can help with their experiences as a result of the pandemic.
And is there a generational divide as you look at this? Because I'm seeing it. Some of the older line senior directors, managers, leaders are more prone to wanting to be in the office. And our younger staff are saying, hey, I should be able to work wherever I want to work. As long as I get my work done, that should be enough. Are you seeing that?
Yeah. And the data are pretty clear on this. There's absolutely a divide. I can tell you personally, this has been kind of an interesting experience. You know, at McKinsey, we all work on dispersed teams that are in hybrid mode right now. And absolutely, you see differences. And, you know, part of this is, you know, kind of the younger generations prioritizing different aspects of life, right? You know, a greater emphasis perhaps on flexibility and well-being. I think the other part of this, though, is there's a really interesting thing that happens, though, is you don't know what you don't know, right? If I've never been in the office, right, then how can I possibly say that that's a good thing? I mean, we have some folks at McKinsey who have literally never been in a McKinsey office, and they've been with us for over a year. right? So I think there's a lot of factors at work, but pretty consistently we see in the data that there's a pretty significant generational divide.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More with McKinsey & Company partner Brooke Weddle coming soon. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with Brooke Weddle, a partner at international management consulting firm McKinsey & Company, about how the pandemic has impacted the future of work. All right, so I keep on hearing this little fun sentence that the office is going to become the new offsite.
Yes.
And I kind of get what that means, sort of theoretically, I get what that means, but what do you think that means?
I think it means that we have an opportunity to reinvent the office. You know, think about the most fabulous offsite you've ever been to. Imagine if showing up at the office was a little bit more like that.
That would be great. But let me just add one thing.
Yeah.
There is a tremendous amount of work that goes into the planning of an offsite.
Yes.
Do you mean that we have to do that every week for the couple of days a week or 3 days a week that people are going to be in the office?
Yeah. Well, so I think that if you look at traditional offices, they typically dedicate 2/3 of their space right now to individual heads down workspaces. So I think there's an upfront reinvention of the physical space, right, in terms of fostering different kinds of experiences. Then I do think there are tactical and strategic things you can do to foster collaboration. So having people show up on the same day, if you're on the same team, that's perhaps an obvious one. But what about spontaneous connections? How do you foster those, right? That's where you get into a little bit of the orchestration in terms of ensuring that, you know, if I'm not on your team, how do I, you know, how is there the potential for us to interact, right? And I think, you know, leaders are starting to think through how to create that. And in terms of, you know, ensuring that they're thinking through the role categories that might need some of that spontaneous interaction. I do think that the value proposition for being in an office has already changed. So it's not even like this is an option. We have to rethink that space in order to get people back.
So I've read a lot about the four C's. So
yeah.
Connection, collaboration, creativity, and culture, and that the four C's work best when staff are together in person. So first, do you agree with that, that that's where the four C's really thrive? And so if that's the case, does that mean that there should be set days when everyone is in the office together at the same time? But what do you think about that?
I think there's, again, data on both sides. I do think that, you know, some of the employers, and we've all read about them in the press, some employers would point to data that show that productivity and connectedness is actually better facilitated through in-person interactions. On the other side of the equation, there is a growing base of data that show that actually you can form those connections in virtual environments. And so I see both things being true. And so I don't necessarily think that you have to be in person to foster the four C's and to build those. But I probably wouldn't go to the other end of the spectrum either. I don't think that, you know, when you think about employee turnover and when you think about some of the big, you know, strategic decisions and a company needs to make, I do think that there's a time and a place for in-person interactions that actually add value. So I think, you know, we're probably headed to our future that, you know, contemplates both. But probably a little bit more of the remote, given what we've seen in terms of, you know, the amazing, you know, kind of outcomes associated with the pandemic from a work perspective.
So I read voraciously the business press on this topic, because I don't think anyone can be in the business world and not care about what's going to happen this fall. Do you worry about a clash between the managerial class and the worker class come this fall, when people get, quote unquote, invited back to the office? Because everywhere I read, the surveys are quite clear. The workers, if you will, don't really want to come back. And the management, to use that term, want people back. And people are quitting their jobs. They're saying, listen, if you want me back, that's fine. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to quit. I'm going to find another employer who will allow me to work remotely. So do you see the fall and winter as being quite volatile in the workplace?
Well, so I'm an inherently positive person. So okay. instead of seeing a great clash, I see an opportunity for a great conversation. And I don't mean to come across as naive. I do know that there is data, again, to show that companies that are communicating more are actually having employees who feel less burnt out and feel more included. So first of all, we've got to start communicating more. And I do think there's an opportunity to have a dialogue about what might be, you know, some middle ground in this potential debate. I also think that, you know, things are already evolving. So some of these companies that said, you know, we're going to come back and be in office after Labor Day have already switched again, or at least pushed that back out. Some of these, you know, big iconic companies have already come out saying that, mostly because of the Delta variant. So it's going to be dynamic. It is going to be a journey. When you think about what's happening now, you know, some are even comparing this to the Industrial Revolution, when we went from farms to factories, or during World War II, when women came into the office, right? This is not something that's going to play out in the next 12 months. It's going to play out for many years. And so that's why I would call it a great conversation, and one that's not only going to take place not only this fall, but going forward as well into the future.
In the last 90 seconds that we have left, what three pieces of advice would you give to businesses and enterprise leaders during this liminal time between the pandemic and the new normal after times?
Right. So three pieces of advice. The first is communicate. I cited the data earlier. It's pretty powerful. Communicate when you know the answer, communicate when you don't know the answer, and lead with why. We've probably all seen that research on why it's important to appeal to why and meaning. And I think now is an important time to double down on that. The second is to listen, test, and adjust. Don't listen to your employees to kind of pick the things that would reinforce the policies you were already going to put in place. Truly listen and have an open mind about what you could learn during this experiment and be iterative. The final one is revisit norms and rituals. So culture, as we all know, is built on a foundation of norms and rituals. That's what makes the day-to-day experience truly unique and collective. And it's a great time to re-examine those norms and rituals. Think about which of them you might recast or reimagine in a way that helps you achieve your goals.
So thank you so very much. And thank you for what you're doing to help so many organizations around the world be better at what they do.
Of course. It was great to be here. It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime, on demand, with the SiriusXM app, or wherever you like to find your podcasts.